Hi, I'm Michael Strahan, and join me for Giant Steps to make it a Big Blue's first Super Bowl champion, an oral history from the Players Tribune, powered by digital media. Relive the moment that shaped the 1986 Giants as told by the men who contributed to that legendary defense, Bill Parcells.
It puts these guys together forever, and that's never going to change because they're each other's guys, and there's only a few of them.
Harry Carson, Pepper Johnson, Elvis Patterson, George Martin, Leonard Marshall, Carl Banks, and of course, LT Lawrence Taylor.
Nobody played with us. We was absolutely dominant. It was like men playing with boys. Nobody played with us. You can smell it. You can feel it. We could do anything. Anything.
Subscribe via iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts so that you can get Giant Steps to make it a Big Blue's first Super Bowl champion.
Hello and welcome back to another episode of Open Floor. I'm Andrew Sharp, and on the other line, Ben Golliver. What's up, man?
Not too much, Andrew. We've got mailbag questions from all over the globe. Places that I didn't even know had internet service. They've managed to send us in some great mailbag questions this week. But I think first what we really need to do is have a dramatic reading of Rajon Rondo's absolutely ridiculous Instagram post that has lit the internet ablaze over the last 24 hours.
Yeah, I put it in there for you. Do you want to read it or should I take it?
Oh, I've been waiting to read it and then just flip out about it and lose my mind about it for about the last 12 or 14 hours. I barely could sleep last night. Okay, I don't want to like start analyzing it before we've even put it out there, but it's insane.
Read the post. You were fired up when you were texting me about this last night. I have a different take, predictably, but do your thing.
Rajon Rondo pulls up his cell phone and begins tapping with a picture of his former Celtics teammates dramatically presented on Instagram. And it reads, "My vets would never go to the media. They would come to the team. My vets didn't pick and choose when they wanted to bring it. They brought it every time they stepped in the gym, whether it was practice or a game. They didn't take days off. My vets didn't care about their numbers. My vets played for the team. When we lost, they wouldn't blame us. They took responsibility and got in the gym. They showed the young guys what it meant to work. Even in Boston, when we had the best record in the league, if we lost a game, you could hear a pin drop on the bus. They showed us the seriousness of the game. My vets didn't have an influence on the coaching staff. They couldn't change the plan because it didn't work for them. I played under one of the greatest coaches, and he held everyone accountable." Editor's note, he was not talking about Fred Hoiberg. Okay. "It takes 1 to 15 to win. When you isolate everyone, you can't win consistently. I may be a lot of bad things, but I'm not a bad teammate." Alternate fact. "Okay. My goal is to pass what I learned along. The young guys work. They show up. They don't deserve the blame. If anything is questionable, it's the leadership."
Well, great work there. Great dramatic reading. I appreciate it. I just want to take this opportunity to remind everyone that the Ubuntu Celtics never lost a playoff series when Kendrick Perkins was healthy. And this is hilarious. And I kind of appreciate Rondo for putting it all out on the table like this.
Okay, so before we get to Rondo's comments, let's quickly talk about what Jimmy said and what Wade said after the loss. I mean, they did kind of say, basically their message was, "We've got guys on this roster who don't care as much as us," was the general gist of it. Did you have a problem with that message? Because that is not something you usually hear all-star level guys throwing out there.
A little bit, yeah. I mean, particularly from Wade, who has been pretty inconsistent for the Bulls. And even Jimmy Butler, like, I'm not sure what he expects the Bulls to be, but he's throwing like younger players under the bus and guys who are working hard and who just aren't that talented. Like if they want to act like this is a championship team or a contender, then that's fine. But I feel like both of them, particularly Wade, share in the blame for what's wrong. And it was kind of a it's disingenuous to pretend that they should be like an elite team in the East.
I mean, when I was reading Jimmy's comments and watching the video of it, I really had flashbacks to childhood where, like, you just be so frustrated at your parents for whatever the situation might have been. You know, you didn't get to watch the TV show you wanted, whatever nonsense punishment that they had left you with.
Yeah.
And so you just take it out. You take it out on your little brothers, right? And,
right.
Like, unfortunately, they bear the brunt of your anger, and it's unfair, and everybody realizes the true source of the frustration. And Jimmy's in a weird spot because, like, he tries to not ever go after management. You know, he tries to say, oh, that's above my pay grade, yada, 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 like superstars are supposed to say. Well, but he has every possible reason to be frustrated with what Chicago's done here over the last 12 months trying to build around him, right?
Okay, and here's where I'm sort of Team Rondo, is that, like, most of his criticisms are spot on. I mean, I will say that his vets would not have posted a, like, extended rant on Instagram to settle their beef, but like a good team doesn't go to the media. I do think it's probably a fair criticism if you're on the Bulls to look at Jimmy Butler and say that you care a lot about your numbers. I think it's a fair criticism to say that Wade picks and chooses when he wants to bring it, and like when we lost, they wouldn't blame us. Like, it's kind of bullshit for Wade and Jimmy Butler to suddenly say that this season is Michael Carter Williams' fault. You know what I mean?
Paul Zipser's not the answer is what you're trying to say?
Yeah, like, come on. And aside from the hilarity of Rondo just going full heel here, like, he has some decent points. And I'm curious as to whether he'll ever have a job in the NBA again. I think he might be shifting into the China phase of his career, but you can't fault him for the honesty here.
So a few things.
You're about to fault him. I understand that, but
I'm about to dissect him into pieces. But first of all, with regard to Jimmy, I mean, that's a good point. With his numbers, though, to me, the biggest number is just the impact, the on-off. I mean, when he's off the court, the Bulls are worse than the Nets, okay?
Yeah, he's a good player.
Whatever he's doing in terms of getting his own numbers, it's the only reason why Chicago is anywhere close to the playoff picture. Without him, and even if you were trying to run things through Rondo, the amazing playmaker, the genius point guard, he's got the unbelievable vision, according to like four people who still believe in him, they would be one of the worst teams in the Eastern Conference, even
all
with
right,
Wade
all
out
right.
there.
Hold on. Would you not agree that Jimmy Butler has become more ball dominant over the last few years? Like, yes, he makes them better, but that's because the Bulls suck.
That's exactly my point. I'm not excusing every decision he's making. I'm sure there's some tough shots in there, but the guy goes hard to the basket. He generates pretty quality looks. He's their best all-around player on both ends. He doesn't let up on defense despite the extra load on offense. And when he's not on the court, they are atrocious. I mean, they're worse than like the Pacers when Paul George is off the court. I mean, the amount of help that he has and how little help that help makes sense in terms of building around him, it's a stark contrast. I mean, look how well things are set up for Harden in Houston. Now look how well things are set up for Jimmy in Chicago. I mean, it's a joke.
Yeah, okay. I mean, I wouldn't argue that, but I still think that a lot of these criticisms apply, especially like, I don't know what the dynamics are with Jimmy and Hoiberg, but it has never really seemed all that healthy between those two. And, you know, it's not to say that he's clearly the best player, clearly the MVP of their season, but like, he is part of the problem too.
I think his outburst after the game the other night was more a byproduct of the problem rather than a cause of the problem.
Yeah, actually, I shouldn't say he's part of the problem, because honestly, every NBA person I talked to before the year said that, looked at this roster and said, look, they're going to be like bouncing between the 7th and 9th seed all year. And that's exactly what's happened. So I don't even know if there is a problem. This team just isn't very good.
Yeah, the problem is that management screwed up with their entire offseason strategy, did not target people who make Jimmy's life better or easier or complement his skills. They allowed his name to be put into trade rumors. They didn't show him that usual type of like franchise player type respect that a guy with his skill set would, you know, usually expect to receive in the NBA. And so lo and behold, and they have a coach who, you know, clearly there was issues last year as well. So lo and behold, these things are kind of coming home to roost all simultaneously. And he looks like the bad guy because, you know, he's frustrated that they blow a game down the stretch. I mean, I think the problems clearly, I think the takeaway from Jimmy's comments and also Rondo's comments are that the problems are not necessarily with the people in the locker room. It's with the people who put together this roster.
Yeah.
But in terms of Rondo's approach, though.
All right, here we go.
Well, one thing that I thought that reminded me of was, I told you earlier this season how DeMarcus Cousins, like the Sacramento media is like afraid of him.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not a very like respectful fear. It's just like an actual fear. Kevin Garnett, you know, back in those like late Celtics days, I mean, I wasn't really covering them at all in the playoffs for their real heyday, like the title team. I came a few years after that. But the level of like fearful respect or like respectful fear, however you want to put it, for Kevin Garnett, I mean, he wouldn't have gone to the media because the media was afraid to ask him for comments. Like, he was just allowed to like walk out the back of the locker room, not address the media. And that was just like how things went. So they definitely had something special there in terms of how they kept things in-house and the personalities.
Looking back, that team was much cooler than I think a lot of people realized at the time. And I like my Ubuntu playoff series thing, like that was the original Warriors 3-1 meme. But for real though, that team was great, and it was a special group. And so I am not even kidding. I read that Instagram and was like, man, that was a dope squad. I respect you. Like, that was back when I loved Rondo. But yes, you're right that everyone was difficult with the media there. Rondo especially. I heard some stories of him just being kind of an a-hole.
Oh, for sure. They had tons of internal comments. And I think what his take was is that he's used to this teammate-on-teammate violence, right?
Yeah.
And he's not used to having it play out in the media. And I guess, you know, that's a somewhat fair point. But here's the problem with how Rondo did this. He is just caked in hypocrisy. If you go down almost every single one of these statements that he's saying about guys like Pierce and guys like Garnett, it's very clear that he didn't internalize those lessons and apply them to himself. He says his vets would never go to the media. He is going to the media. He's saying that the vets would go to the team. He's not going to the team. He's saying that the vets didn't pick and choose when they wanted to bring it. Rondo picks and chooses when he wants to bring it within possessions. Like, he'll play hard for the first six possessions and then just stop playing for the rest of the possession. Not to mention he played his way out of a job, even though they've got nobody else at that spot who's competent really at all.
Yeah.
I think he might be Mr. Pick and Choose when to bring it in the entire league.
This is a real do as I say, not as I do situation.
It's one of the most hypocritical things.
Because Rondo especially, I've never seen anyone stat chase more than Rajon Rondo over the last like 3 to 4 years. It started toward the end of his Celtics days where he was like his assist chasing was pretty amazing to watch.
Look, this is ghostwritten by Sean Spicer. There's no question in my mind. He says, my vets didn't care about their numbers. Who cares about their numbers more than anyone in the entire league besides Rajon Rondo?
Yeah, look, fair enough. All right. I just love the Celtics. I love Rondo turning heel. And
here's my favorite part. He says it takes 1 to 15 to win. 2 weeks ago, he told David Aldridge he could name three of his teammates in Sacramento last year.
That's a good point. All right.
Yeah. It takes 1 to 15 to win. Well, what about the other 12 whose names you don't remember from 6 months ago? Yeah. When you isolate everyone, you can't win consistently. Who's one of the weirdest guys that nobody can seem to understand, who has to constantly get into fights with his coaches and bailed in the middle of a playoff series? Who does that sound like? Someone who isolates himself and doesn't win consistently. And then on top of all of that, he concludes with, I may be a lot of things, but I'm not a bad teammate. Well, I would love to see a survey of his former teammates and coaches to see if they could fact check that statement like the Washington Post, because he's coming out with like 19 Pinocchios on that.
Yeah, no.
All right, fair, I'm done.
Fair
I'm done.
Enough.
I'm done.
I also want to point out that when you talk about settling things internally, I think there was one feature, it was probably like a year or two ago, about Rondo in Boston. And there was one day where he just, like in the middle of a film session, smashed the TV and walked out of the building. So, yeah, the teammate thing is a little questionable. But, hey, it was a great way to end the week. It was a wild week. I feel like we talked Monday afternoon and I was kind of down. And it was just like, all right, whatever. Let's get to the All-Star break. And then the whole league just went nuts. And every day there was something hilarious happening. And it really sort of brought me back. It was restorative. I want to start here. We've got some questions.
Well, actually, hold on though. Two last things on the Rondo thing real quick. Okay. Number one, I think that the clear ulterior motive of his rant was to force management's hand to make a decision with him so that he can go play somewhere else. You look at Cleveland, you know, their talk about another ball handler. You look at the Clippers, you know, CP's out, Doc's there, Kevin Garnett's around the team a lot. There are situations where I'm sure he's trying in his head to fantasize they're going to be better than Chicago. And he basically needs them to kind of pull the plug in and stop having him rot on the bench. So I think that was a primary motive here.
Yeah.
And I think that could be something that they act on, you know, fairly quickly. And second, just to watch Rondo's self-immolation during a week in which we also had the funeral was just so great. I mean, there was so much just, you know, end of time stuff happening in the NBA. Like the dog days immediately turned into the apocalypse here in like a 3-day period.
Yeah. Well, so we're going to get to LeBron. We're going to get to Melo rumors. What else happened? We've got a question about Dion Waiters game winner. It was a wild week, but for me, it started to get fun around Monday night at like 11:30 when someone tweeted a story at me saying that the Wizards were planning to wear all black to the Celtics Wizards game in the middle of January.
I loved it. I also thought that was Kelly Oubre was the one who said that first to the media, right?
It was actually John Wall who told them about it, but it was Bradley Beal's idea, which I loved. And I mean, so we've got two questions here. Glenn Yap asks, how fun is the budding rivalry between the Seas and Wiz? Who do we pray to make it a 4-5 matchup in the first round? And then another one says, Sir Ah, who actually tweeted the story at me initially, says, have you ever partied harder at a funeral? So I am, first of all, I'm going to laugh for the rest of my life about the Wizards wearing all black to a regular season game in January and treating it like it was like a game 7. And it was all hilarious leading up to it. And then I went to the game. I actually switched my schedule around so I could make it to that game. And like by the second quarter, I really, really wanted to win that game. I was taking it as seriously as Bradley Beal. And I know this is hard for you to believe, but I try to keep it pretty neutral when I'm at games. Generally, like I was there as a fan, not a journalist.
I do.
But by the fourth quarter, when Bradley Beal was just like punking Marcus Smart over and over and over again, it was like something came over me and it was primal. And I think I stood up and told Marcus Smart to get the F out of the building. And I was screaming.
What?
I don't know, man. Look, you weren't there at the funeral. It was a strange scene and it was awesome.
So I actually reviewed the videotape and Marcus Smart had a real altercation with the Celtics assistant sort of late in that fourth quarter. And I guess he was telling them that you needed to be ejected by security because you had been so disrespectful.
Yeah. Look, Bradley Beal ruined Marcus Smart's life. And what people don't know about that, like the funeral in general, is that it really started by Marcus Smart, who basically he fouls someone on every single possession, and he was getting overly physical with Beal, and they were starting to fight back and forth. And Beal has taken a lot of hits about his toughness over the years, so like it was number one, encouraging to see him fight back during the previous Celtics game, and then it bubbled over into Wall and Crowder at the end, and Isaiah Thomas saying, I think Isaiah was like going through the locker room saying, "We're the real killers over here." And look, the Wizards straight up punked those dudes. And like, I am not impressed with the Celtics. We're going to talk about the Celtics next week, but it was pretty awesome.
Okay, a few thoughts here. First, I had flashbacks to middle school, because when I was in like, I don't know, like fifth or sixth, seventh grade, I read a story about how Michael Jordan wears Carolina blue, you know, college shorts underneath his game shorts. And like, that's what he considers as like his key to success, or, you know, his lucky charm.
Yeah.
So of course I started doing that, cause I was like, well, obviously if, you know, Jordan's doing it, I do it, I'm going to become like Michael Jordan. Right. That's what the Wizards reminded me of. Like, they had read about this whole all black funeral thing in like an NBA history book. And they were like, oh, this is going to be great. Like, we can just like live this out. And as you pointed out, maybe the time to do that is for a game seven in a postseason series, not a random Tuesday in January.
Yeah.
But my other thought was exactly what you closed on. And this was sort of my grade for the Celtics, you know, and they're in my midseason report card. You know, I closed on this thought. The Wizards of all people proved with their funeral that no one has real cause to fear these Celtics. Celtics are a cute story. They've, you know, this MVP talk with Isaiah continues to be absolutely hilarious. They're not a team you have to be afraid of. They're a team that you can call to the carpet, even when Marcin Gortat's showing up to the arena beforehand, like, don't blame me, guys. It wasn't my idea to wear black, because he's a little bit nervous that they're not good enough to back it up.
Yeah.
And then they can still crush the Celtics, because the Celtics don't play defense well enough. They don't have the right front court pieces. And, you know, if you really lock them down and get serious about your own defense, you can slow their offense down too. So, I love the killer instinct from Beal. There's so many of those guys who we wish would show that. You know, how great would it be if Andrew Wiggins was doing that every single night? And you go right down the list of some of these, you know, two guards or small forwards who, if they always showed that killer instinct, would just be so great. But I loved Washington's response. I loved the entire circus of it. And I also loved the trip down memory lane. I mean, blue basketball shorts, wearing all black. Yeah, those are definitely the keys to success on the court.
Yeah, it was a solid night. I also, stray note from that game, the Celtics should burn those long-sleeved gray jerseys. I mean, the Wizards jerseys were not much better that night, but I the Celtics should always wear white or green. And I don't want to bury them for
yeah.
real.
The Wizards showed up to a funeral and the Celtics showed up to a pajama party.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And I don't want to bury them for real. Like, if the Wizards were in a playoff series against the Celtics, it would be a straight up toss up. Like, Brad Stevens is still great. They still find ways to do things to win. And Avery Bradley wasn't playing. And when Avery Bradley's not in there, like, the rest of their guards are just not very good beyond Isaiah. I will say a couple more things. One of the reasons that game was so great is because the Wizards and DC sports in general generally will, like, when there's that much hype, it generally ends in like humiliation and just extreme heartbreak. That's certainly what I was expecting going in, and that's probably part of the reason I was so fired up towards the end. The other thing about the Celtics that struck me watching in person is, like, the Wizards lost out on Al Horford this summer, and Horford right now just, like, doesn't look very good, and it's got to be a little bit concerning. Like, he is about Marcin Gortat level, only $100 million more expensive. And that would freak me out if I were in year one of the deal. And he's already, I think, like 31 or 32. I mean, he's Joakim Noah's age. So that's an issue. And the other thing with the Celtics is John Wall and Isaiah Thomas. It's interesting. Like, I talked about how close the call was for the All-Star game for my vote as a star voting for the starters. But man, when you put them on the same court together, Isaiah has been playing really well, but there's a difference between having a great year and actually being great. And I think like Wall, when he's locked in, it's just no contest between those two.
It's almost like both sides of the basketball matter, like I've been screaming for the last 2 months.
It's not just that, but yeah, it definitely, it's an issue. All right, so two more quick whiz questions. David Wilson, is the Wizards' 38-year division title drought the most embarrassing DC sports failure? Also, will tag team play at your funeral? Tag team, so that's another thing you might not have realized. It was 90s night at Verizon Center. And tag team performed at halftime. It was delightful. But I think most embarrassing DC sports failure, there's like a 20-way tie for first place on that one. But the 38 years is a long time. So, yeah, I don't even pay attention to division titles, but that's amazing. I didn't know that that was a real stat. One more. Will Gong asks, if you redraft today, Justice Winslow or Stanley Johnson or Kelly Oubre, who are you taking?
Justice Winslow.
Okay. And then would you, I mean, look, this is peak Wizards optimism. They'll probably lose in Atlanta and New Orleans this weekend. So let me get this off my chest now. Kelly Oubre is starting to show some signs. Like I would think pretty hard about taking him above Stanley Johnson, not Justice Winslow, but Oubre's the ceiling is there.
Well, like we've always said, I mean, Ernie Grunfeld's got to be in that conversation for executive of the year.
Yeah, exactly. I was on a podcast, a Strictly Wizards podcast last week called the Zardcast, and they asked what Wizards opinions do you not feel comfortable sharing with Ben? And I was like, yeah, I don't think I'm allowed to bring up my Kelly Oubre takes on the podcast because he will check out immediately. So I'm just testing the waters here, but we can move on.
Well, we got a question from Bosnian Bear who says, is LeBron creating a diversion of some sort purposely? Is he preventing them from peaking too early and aiming for a reset? First of all, thank you, Bosnian Bear, for sending in a non-Wizards question. Second of all, do you have any thoughts?
I've successfully hijacked the podcast with the help of listeners. All right. There were two things that made me laugh for like a solid 15 minutes when I saw them this week. The first one was the Wizards' funeral attire. And the second one was the next day, LeBron's tweets about David Griffin.
I gotta read these.
Okay.
LeBron tweets, I'm not mad or upset at management, which clearly, obviously, that means he is. Then he says, cause Griffin staff have done a great job. Well, okay. Then he goes on, I just feel that we need to still improve in order to repeat. ... And then he doesn't go with the twit longer. He actually has a separate tweet to really drive the point home. And then he says, if that's what we want to do, we still need to improve in order to repeat ... if that's what we want to do. When you sent that to me, I blanked. I was trying to every possible way to realize that it was a fake. Like I thought it was made up because it was too delicious to be true, but no, it was a real tweet.
Dude, I was dying. I'm so happy that Subtweet LeBron is back. My serious take on this is that the playoff rotation is going to be much shorter. And if I were him, I would not be this freaked out about the bench. And I'd also have faith in them to address the point guard situation, the backup point guard situation over the next month. They still have a pick that they can trade. They've got different exceptions they can use. But mostly it's not an NBA season if we don't have like some legendary LeBron subtweets interspersed there.
My serious take on it is very straightforward. And honestly, I am just cruising around on my high horse this week because Mr. Accountability, Ben Golliver, that's me, finally has some big time advocates on my side. First, it was Steve Kerr going off on the players for wasting their all-star votes, which I loved, calling it a mockery of the process a few days after I flipped out on the players for how many votes they wasted on the likes of Daniel House, who you probably voted for all-star. But then LeBron comes through and takes my ultimate accountability opinion and applies it to himself. I mean, I've been screaming for people to play for gold here instead of bronze.
Right.
I've been screaming for these second tier contenders like Boston and Toronto to make the move that puts them over the top so they can compete with Cleveland. And here is LeBron preaching the same message to the Cavaliers. I almost wept tears of joy. This is the attitude that we need. We have way too many people out there like yourself who are trying to argue that cost-controlled draft picks and playing for your championship window 4 years from now is a way to do it. No.
All right.
Enough of
all
that.
All right. Hold on.
Way too much of that. We need some people going for the title and trying to win the trophy this year. I respect LeBron. I wish Kyle Lowry had said that. I wish Isaiah Thomas had said that. I wish the Clippers core guys would say that. I want to hear that from everybody who's serious about doing it right now. Thank you, LeBron.
Yeah. I passed out from how hot that take was, but I appreciate it. And to answer Boston,
I'm like half serious.
Yeah,
but
no,
I'm on Team LeBron here. They need to get better,
hold on,
right?
Hold
I mean,
on.
We've seen Golden State's talent's unbelievable, isn't he? Right?
To answer,
don't they need more help?
To answer the question from Bosnian Bear, I don't think that that LeBron is trying to create a diversion to prevent them from peaking early. I think he's seriously this pissed off. I think it's like genuine. I think part of it is probably connected to resentment to Dan Gilbert, and that's always fair, and we support it. However, like when you talk about playing for gold, you do understand that gold is not like a January game against the Pelicans or an overtime loss to the Kings, right?
No, but it is a midseason move that helps you match up better with Golden State. And that's sort of the bigger point. Like, I think he's playing too many minutes. I think LeBron should take 3 weeks off
he
and
should.
Get his mind right.
He absolutely should. Yeah. It's weird to me that they are taking this season so seriously. I mean, like, if LeBron wants to play for gold, honestly, just go to South Beach for 3 weeks and stop playing 40 minutes a game. I'm totally with you there. And
well, by the way, if they were still winning and he was only playing 33 minutes a night, these comments never happen. I mean, I think that's really the true source of them is that just like every other coach LeBron's ever had, Ty Lue, newly minted champion Ty Lue, can't help himself from running LeBron into the ground because every time LeBron's on the court, they look good. Every time he comes off the court, they look terrible. I mean, that's been the story his entire career, basically, with some, you know, a few exceptions there in Miami when he had a little bit more help, but you know, that's the endless riddle with LeBron is like, how do you properly manage his minutes so that you're winning enough to feel like you have positive momentum, but you're not, you know, overtaxing him. And to me, his comment sounded like he was tired and he was hoping for maybe more from Kyle Korver. He didn't call Kyle Korver out, but like you make that move because you're trying to lessen LeBron's load. And then these comments come out, what, like 10 days later? I mean, clearly not enough changed with that one.
Yeah. So one other, I mean, David Griffin deserves a lot of credit for how well he's built the roster over the last 3 years, including the Korver trade. Like that was whether it pays off or not, that was a smart play from Cleveland. And it was
totally
clever.
Agree.
And like it's still amazing. And we're going to get to Waiters in a second, but it's still amazing that David Griffin was able to turn Dion Waiters into J.R. Smith and Timofey Mozgov. I mean, that alone should buy him immunity from LeBron's ire. And like they've forfeited some flexibility by filling the bench out with LeBron's guys year after year.
Yeah, I mean, I kind of got LeBron's point, though, about the younger pieces at the end of the bench, right? Like, they did try to scrape by saving pennies here and there, in part because LeBron wanted the full max, and they obviously wanted to give that to him. So they were making some very minor penny-pinching decisions around the edges, and I can understand why LeBron would say, like, look, I might only be this good for the next 2 years. Don't pinch on me now, you know, pinch in 2019.
I still wonder whether that's part of why he left Miami, because Miami was starting to make those decisions
toward
the end.
And it definitely was. Definitely.
But to be clear, Cleveland's not been afraid to pay the luxury tax, which Mickey Arison was. Like, they're paying money, and I'm definitely not Team Dan Gilbert. I don't think that this is that dramatic. Like, whether they sign
Rajon
Rondo or not, it's not gonna like make or break their chances against the Warriors.
Well, you said, you know, give Griffin credit. That's absolutely right. And it pains me to say this, but we got to give Dan Gilbert credit too. I mean, his motto was all in, which is like a really sketchy casino motto, given that there's a casino right now next door to the stadium.
I was
going to
say, we don't need to give him that much credit because he's parlay. It's not like he's losing money in any of these deals. Like he is paying more money to see the value of his franchise double, to see his stadium renovated with like mostly taxpayer money. He's making money on the casino. Like Dan Gilbert is doing fine, but yes, he's still not been by the standards of NBA owners.
Yeah, by standards of NBA owners, he is paying more than everyone else and has shown the willingness to do that.
Yeah.
And that's a hit on some level. So I didn't even really read this as like a LeBron call. I thought it was more, you know, like as I was saying earlier, is this is accountability, LeBron. I mean, he wants to make sure that they don't take their foot off the gas because Golden State looks deeper and more talented than Cleveland right now, period, on paper. I think we would all agree with that. The advanced numbers and especially their recent play, like over the last month, I mean, there's really been no competition between those two teams. And I would be getting a little bit nervous if I was LeBron because he knows when he's about to walk into a finals, that's not going to go great for him. He's been blown out in the finals by the Spurs. They've been handled by the Warriors the first time. And there's a fine line between having a shot against Golden State and being able to beat them if they beat themselves, which is sort of Cleveland's best case scenario, I think, and then feeling like you don't have a shot at all. And I don't know if there's a, like you're saying, is a minor backcourt midseason move going to swing that balance? Not nearly as much as getting J.R. Smith back. I mean, not nearly as much as being able to rest for the first three playoff rounds because you have easy opponents in the Eastern Conference. I mean, there are going to be factors in Cleveland's favor. So I actually like the speech from LeBron. I mean, I thought it was more of a, kind of a refocusing of their attention on, hey, let's not settle in any way. And he probably could have delivered that message better, but I was with it.
All right, cool. I mean, I don't have any problem with it. I honestly was mostly just amazed by that second tweet, if that's what we want to do. And side note, while you were talking, I just remembered that last year around this time, do you remember the Instagram that LeBron posted of, it was a cartoon of himself as like a downtrodden Batman?
I do. And this goes back to the Rondo thing. It's like, I never realized that I was going to need to be completely fluent in Instagram shade and memes to like be able to do my job. I mean, the level of complexity that we're getting from guys like Courtney Lee with the Dumb and Dumber Instagram posts. I mean, every single day someone's putting something on Instagram that's like hieroglyphics for the modern age, and we have to try to like translate the meaning into ordinary everyday English.
But nobody is better than LeBron. He's the original. He's the GOAT. Subtweet LeBron, it's great to have you back. What was it? What was the like language? Oh, Da Vinci Code LeBron. Yeah, it was just all part of the greatest hits. But we should move on to LeBron's former sidekick, Andre in Rio, asks, please tell us your reactions to Dion Waiters' arm crossed, the city is mine celebration. What other unlikely NBA hero would you like to see, and what kind of embarrassing celebration would he be doing?
Well, I'm going to be the wettest possible
blank
here.
Oh, my God.
I didn't find it, you know, I didn't find it that amusing. His team's terrible. He's still bad. I wouldn't pay him. I wouldn't want him on my team. And spoiler alert, I asked you if you would take Dion Waiters to fill out Washington's amazing bench, and you ran away from your phone.
I didn't. My exact response that night was no, because some pure bucket getters are too pure. And that's how I feel about Dion Waiters. But it was great. Well,
real quick. Quick shout out to Kenny Ducey, one of the SI guys. He did an interview with Dion Waiters, and for whatever reason, Waiters went to the cliche of it's a make or miss league, but he said it backwards. So he said it's a miss or make league, and I thought that is what should be on Waiters' gravestone. That should be tattooed across the back of his shoulders. It's a miss or make league. Yes, it certainly is for Dion Waiters.
I'm happy for him. And as far as other unlikely NBA heroes, I think there's only one correct answer here. And we need a Rajon Rondo game winner sometime within the next week, followed by him walking out, flipping the bird to all of his teammates in Chicago.
How would that even happen, though? I mean, what kind of a shot can he even make at this point? Like, is it going to have to be like a botched alley-oop that accidentally goes in the basket?
I just want a Rajon Rondo revenge game against his own teammates. It's been a great year. It's been a great year in Chicago.
We are like maybe 10 days away from Rondo just scoring in his own basket and walking off the court at halftime.
Yeah, dude, I don't actually know how things can get worse in Chicago. I have faith that they can, but it's pretty nasty right now. I mean, Wade, we didn't even talk about Wade posting the Michelle Obama meme on Twitter. Like, that was even before Rondo.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot going on there. Yeah. And what was funny was I did my midseason grades, and it really had a solid shelf life of about 4 hours, because my entire section about the Bulls was like, imagine if Jimmy ever went off on the Bulls management like LeBron went off on Dan Gilbert and Griffin. Like, he has so much more to complain about, and yet that hasn't happened yet. And then like 6 hours later, their entire team gets nuclear wastelanded.
I mean, I think that's Dwayne Wade comparing MCW to Donald Trump, which... Things have gotten dark. That's all you can say about Chicago. It's been a wild year.
Look, D-Wade, leave the stretch political comparisons to yours truly. Yeah, I got you covered.
Exactly.
All right.
Next question.
Next question.
Cornelius Hoopinstan asks, how fun would Lou Williams be on the Thunder? I think we should all pick a team for Lou Williams, like as a podcast. Lou next to Russ would be pretty fantastic. I would like to find a way to get him to Milwaukee to play the role that like Jason Terry and Dellavedova have kind of been playing, but like not that well. And like the Bucks are starting to really struggle here. So I would prefer to get Lou Williams to play with Giannis.
Yeah. So here's the answer to the question. How fun would it be? Well, it'd be more fun than Lou will with the Lakers right now, because the Lakers have crashed and burned into one of the most depressing teams in the league. And I think he's got to be one of those guys you circle for trade talks. I mean, we said that as soon as he signed, whenever it was a year and a half ago, it makes more sense than ever. The Lakers need to be kind of thinking about who they can sell off. I don't think they're going to have a lot of interest in Mozgov or Deng at this point.
Yeah.
Cashing out on Lou Williams would be a very timely decision at the trade deadline.
So I just did this mock draft today. First one of the year, just sort of feeling things out. It's probably a little early for mocks, but it was fun. And my number one takeaway was that like there is talent all over the top 10 to where like tanking isn't as essential as it would be in other years. Like you can get a guy with superstar potential at like the eighth pick, which is pretty wild to think about. But the exception to that rule is the Lakers. Like they should be tanking. I think Luke Walton came out this week and said
they have to keep their pick.
They really have to, because not only do they need a star to like solidify the nucleus that they're building, because none of those other guys are sure things. Like I think we've discussed, but you know, if you lose that pick, then this is turning into like as miserable a year as anyone can imagine.
Hey, so two quick questions on your mock. First of all, who'd you have number one? And then who do you think makes the most sense for the Lakers as like that long-term guy, given that they already have these other guys, Russell, Randall, and Ingram? I mean, is there somebody who pairs with Ingram better? And then you could just maybe just call Russell a lost cause, or at least de-emphasize him sort of like Denver has with Moutier, so that you're not totally locked into him. I mean, is there somebody in that category?
It's tough. I mean, if you're sliding Russell to the two, or like, because I don't think you could ever bring D'Angelo off the bench, right?
Yeah, I guess the idea would be like you have a transition where you basically let them fight for the starter's job, and then a year and a half down the road, you just trade Russell if he loses it.
Yeah,
you know what I mean?
It might be a trade Russell situation, but there are a lot of very good point guards in the draft. Lonzo Ball is who. Because the Lakers currently have the number two pick. So Lonzo Ball is who I had at number two. And Markel Fultz is phenomenal as well. We can get into more nerdy draft talk next week. But like, basically, if I were them, I'd be looking for a point guard in this draft as D'Angelo Russell insurance. And because most of the wings don't make that much sense. Lauri Markkanen from Arizona, mispronounced his name when we talked about it last week, but he's awesome and he would be a fun fit on that squad. But like beyond that, they need guys who are skilled.
So you had Fultz one, Ball two, and you think would Ball make more sense for the Lakers, you think, than Fultz?
I mean, Ball would be like a god coming out of UCLA and going there, but I think Fultz is is elite to a degree that nobody else in the draft is. Everyone else has star potential, but has some interesting questions about how they'll translate. Fultz is just going to be a really, really good player, and there's like not much to criticize. So I think he's kind of in a class of his own. But again, deep draft. It's going to be a fun little stretch run here. Kansas, Kentucky will actually be pretty great tomorrow. I really like De'Aaron Fox as well, who's kind of like creeping up. I think people are starting to talk themselves into him a little bit more than they were. But back to the NBA for...
Well, real quick, plug alert for Lee Jenkins. He wrote a great story on the Ball UCLA squad. If anyone doesn't read the college basketball stuff that SI puts out, which I'll admit I don't read nearly as much of it as I should. That was a great story and a good insight into what makes him so special. Like you said, I mean, he would really be a phenomenon if he landed on the Lakers.
Yeah.
And that story has a good explanation of why.
Yeah. And Lonzo Ball is awesome. And he's someone that, like, if you'd asked me 6 weeks ago, I was not really excited about him in the NBA. But he is just, his game is unorthodox. And he will, I have a feeling he's going to find a way to be really successful in the NBA. So. That Doughboy asks, you guys spent a while trying to get a point guard to Denver to pair with Jokic. Wouldn't the most fun result be to make a move for Teja Đošić and reunite Serbian Olympic powerhouse? Yes. Oh my God. I cannot believe I didn't think about that myself. Teja Đošić, for people who didn't watch the Olympics, like, that dude is awesome.
Or international basketball for the last 15 years.
Well, yeah. I mean, I got to know him at the Olympics sitting among Serbian basketball reporters who reeked of cigarettes, and I fell in love. So I want him to be in the NBA somewhere, and Denver definitely makes more. We have to make this happen because he did. Recently say that he was open to coming to the NBA within the next year. So I think we need to start this movement.
I mean, he is one of the purest bucket getters. I mean, he has a lot of offensive talent. He'd be a lot of fun. And one thing that I've been thinking about more with Jokic in terms of like, where does this go for Denver? And we were talking about the identity thing and maybe how he's become that team's identity. And I know you claim that you've loved watching them these recent years. I mean, Jokic completely transforms how entertaining and how watchable these guys are. If you found some other guys, guard talent, who played in a similar style, whether that's Teja Đošić or whoever it might be, just...
It would be phenomenal.
Cut from a different cloth than a guy like Moutier, right, whose style is just different. And maybe Murray can actually be that guy. I mean, Murray's, you know, pretty... flashy. I think he can improve as sort of a playmaker with others as he ages a little bit. But that could be a really, really fun team in the not too distant future.
I'm all in on that idea. And rare stat from this side of the podcast. I saw Adam Mares tweet out last night that the Nuggets have a better offensive efficiency than the Warriors over the last 20 games, as Jokic has sort of like taken control of the team. So pretty wild.
Here's another one for you. When he's on the court, their offense is roughly 10 net rating points better than when he's off the court. That's a similar impact to guys like Harden and LeBron James.
Yeah.
So he's not playing as many minutes as those guys. Obviously, Denver's not as good as those guys, but it's very rare for a center who's not like this big three-point shooting threat. He's not like young prime Shaquille O'Neal, just like bodying people, you know, and completely overwhelming people physically on the block. It's very rare for that type of player, you know, this distribution-minded, amazing vision center to have that big of an impact on his team's offensive success. And, you know, he's a baller.
Yeah, he really is. All right, we'll transition to the Melo section of the pod here. Because I don't totally care about Melo trade rumors, but we're about...
You know what's great about these Melo trade rumors? every stock market movie or like financial crisis movie always has that scene where somebody's staring at their computer and like the just ticker is just dropping precipitously and like their sweat like building up on their forehead. They take their glasses off. In some movies, they jump out the window to commit suicide. That is what I felt like with these trade rumors with Melo this week, because we started at Kevin Love, which we had already debunked last week as never going to happen. Then there was like some very, brief, like injured Blake Griffin talk, which again, never going to happen. Within like 2 days, the package became like Austin Rivers and Jamal Crawford. And this is like the stock market scene where Phil Jackson is just watching Carmelo Anthony's trade value crater in front of him. I mean, we're like 3 days away from, well, what about Carmelo for Rondo straight up? I mean, both teams need a change of scenery. We're not that far from that.
What about, did you see this idea from Sean Millions? It's Carmelo to the Spurs, Pau Gasol to the Raptors, and DeJounte Murray and Terrence Ross to the Knicks.
Come on. We already said that Melo is never going to go to San Antonio, and I started like laughing hysterically the last time you mentioned up. And then somebody on ESPN, I forget who it was, or maybe it was TNT, had the same reaction when somebody mentioned Melo as a Spurs target. I just don't see it.
I mean, it would be an entertaining experiment. You have to admit that much, at least. And I feel like the Spurs, like, I want to see the Spurs culture tested at some point. I want to see them trade for someone like Boogie, someone like Melo. Like, let's see how strong it really is, because the last guy, borderline character they had was like Steven Jackson 15 years ago. All I was going to say is
it's been tested. They made Steven Jackson awesome. They made David Lee a big time positive net rating this season.
Yeah.
They have passed every test.
Well, let's see them take on Melo. Let's see them climb Everest here. All right. This is the longest mailbag question we've ever got. Do you want to boil it down from Sean Drought?
Well, I need to just have a little statement here in general. I appreciate every mailbag question. I appreciate everyone who reaches out to me directly with them. I think one of the keys, though, you guys have to realize is that we have to keep these questions under about 4,000 words. Because if you send a 4,000-word question in, we have to then either read the entire thing on the podcast, which just doesn't work, or we have to try to like distill it down. So here's his trade proposal.
Okay.
Carmelo to the Celtics for Tyler Zeller, Jonas Jerebko, Jaylen Brown, and Terry Rozier. And I think he wanted to maybe throw in some draft picks too. But basically the general concept is throw together a bunch of younger prospects that Phil can sell to the public, highlighted around Jaylen Brown. And then add Carmelo to a Celtics team as the piece that maybe goes over the top.
Yeah. I mean, I think that if they can steal a Brooklyn pick, like in the question here says, I think should also maybe include the 2018 Brooklyn pick. It would probably need to. And that would be a much better return than like Austin Rivers and Jamal Crawford. So the bar is pretty low here for the Knicks, but I think that number one, if I were the Celtics, I wouldn't do that. I would try to trade the 2018 Brooklyn pick because I don't think the Nets are going to continue sucking at their current level. So I would try to move that while the value is still high and people are incapable of imagining like a competent Nets team. But at the same,
well, I'm captain pull the trigger. I want Boston to do something. I just don't think that this is the right move. And part of my thought is just point blank, I'd rather have Jaylen Brown on my team than Carmelo Anthony. I mean, that doesn't necessarily mean to win a title this season.
Yeah.
Melo would definitely give you a boost, but you look at the difference. I mean, you're going to pay Melo five times per year what you're going to pay Jaylen Brown. And where's that going to be 18 months from now? What's the difference between those guys going to be? I just wouldn't even part with anyone, and I would consider Brown to be a pretty centerpiece guy for Boston when you look at their like 5 to 10 year plan, right? Like, I don't think you need to trade somebody like that to get Melo back. I just don't think that's sort of the bar here.
Yeah,
I mean, I think his contract and declining skills and everything else that we've always used to kind of talk, maybe quote unquote bash Melo, is dropping his value below even this package.
I would really enjoy seeing Brad Stevens find a way to use Melo and sort of like weaponize his strengths more than they have been over the last few years in New York. But yeah, I don't think it's going to happen for Carmelo on the Celtics. And I also think Carmelo could potentially be like one of the more unpopular Boston athletes in recent memory, which would be pretty amazing. So last question, no one asked about the Clippers, but we should probably talk about the Carmelo Clippers rumors, right?
Yeah, well, so the concept that we didn't even consider because his stock, like I said, dropped so quickly was that the Clippers, with their insanely top-heavy roster, could somehow add him without sacrificing any of their big three. Is that a concept that you would be in favor of? And I've been, you know, down on the idea of Carmelo to the Clippers in the past, but if you're adding him at that small forward spot, you're not sacrificing Blake or DeAndre, and you get to keep Chris, and you can talk yourself into Chris, you know, turning Melo around in terms of making him a more efficient kind of lower usage type player, then yeah, I think that you do that. And
thank you. I was really worried that you were going to say, no, Carmelo is bad on defense. The Clippers can't afford to do that. And I was going to freak out. But yes, if the Clips can make it happen.
The Clippers can't afford it. They can't afford it because they got DeAndre in the back and they got Chris and they got Mba Mute too. I mean, they have defensive pieces to cover for Melo.
Here's the real reason the Clippers should be like angling to make this happen is if they got Melo, then they have pole position to be team banana boat in 2018 when LeBron can opt out of his deal. And you got to do it as an investment in that possibility alone.
You know who loves that idea is Dwayne Wade, because he's probably looking for his next contract already.
Dwayne Wade is ready to leave.
A Southern California golden parachute sounds great to Dwayne Wade. He would love Melo to be the first one to jump so that he could jump and then start recruiting LeBron all over again. I like the idea on the conspiracy level that you're mentioning it, but more importantly, I like the idea as a salvage for this season. And as I was kind of writing about the Clippers this week, it's very tempting to take the, glasses half full approach. Like, they did so well, like, surviving without Blake. They're going to do just fine surviving without Chris, and they're going to be right there in the playoff mix. I mean, that was not the point of this season. The point of this season for them was to really take their best shot at Golden State no matter what. This was the make or break year before they have to pay everybody tons and tons of money and enter kind of a different phase of their franchise, right?
Yeah. Yeah, but the Clippers...
If there is a time or a context to make a kind of a bet on a guy like Carmelo Anthony as someone who could help you get over the hump to like the Western Conference Finals and push Golden State a little bit harder than they've been able to push them in recent years, I think this would be that time. And frankly, their supporting cast guys, whether it's Crawford, Austin Rivers, or whoever else, number one, a lot of those guys are not on great contracts. And number two, they don't have, you know, the longest term future with the team in terms of being like Austin Rivers is not going to succeed, you know, Chris Paul as the point guard of the future, right? Like, these are not indispensable guys.
So let me ask you this.
If you can make it work, do it.
Would trading Carmelo for Austin Rivers be like one final shot from Phil to Carmelo?
Well, I don't know who winds up like feeling worse about that trade, like, Doc for trading his son or Phil for getting absolutely nothing for Carmelo.
I don't know. I think it might be like a spiteful move from him and just sort of sticking it to Carmelo and say, look, you're Austin Rivers. Get out of New York. But,
oh man.
All right. One more question here. Matt Vo asks, playing at the current levels they are right now, if OKC got the band back together, which of KD's super teams would win and what would each team's rotations look like? So I think this is kind of an awesome question. I think he's talking about like if OKC had Harden, Ibaka, and KD, do they beat the KD Warriors?
No.
Really? I think they do. No. I actually don't think... I don't think it would be all that close.
Oh, come on.
In a seven-game series, I would pick the KD-Russ-Harden-Thunder team pizza rolls. I would pick them to win in like five.
Only in fantasy basketball.
Nah, I man. Think, look, you're not going to reduce me to Mr. Highlight here. Look, Harden made that offense work. His ability to handle the ball at the end of games made them work. And that's why trading him was so insane, is that like they only turned the corner when he took over the fourth quarter offense. If you put him back there in the form that he is now, where he's literally like probably going to win MVP, put him with Russ. The only thing we'd have to get like 2011 Ibaka as opposed to the current version. But like, and then you could throw in Nick Collison as the fifth starter, as OKC Zaza. That team, the Warriors have too many weaknesses to beat a team that's that good.
No. Okay, first of all, Draymond Green is the trump card. I mean, I think that his overall ability not only to hold down things defensively, but also facilitate easy shots for all of these star players is the difference.
You are incorrect. I watched the Western Conference Finals, and I watched Kevin Durant ruin Draymond's life in that series and turn him into like a mediocre NBA player. So Durant's defense, but
Kevin Durant is on both teams now. he gets to have Kevin Durant cancel Kevin Durant out.
I understand, but then you could throw Roberson on Warriors Durant, and that would be a decent solution as the fifth starter. Apologies, Nick.
That'd be a good way to watch KD get 30 light.
Fine, but then KD's getting 30 for. All right, we're getting too far in the weeds here.
All I'm saying is I think that my argument is going to be pretty simple. I trust the pass. I trust the Warriors' ability to have the whole of some of the parts come out to a greater sum than the individual brilliance of Oklahoma City's key guys. And I also think that they have better solutions late in games in terms of getting good shots for everybody than Oklahoma City would. And that defensive limitations of the main players, whether it's Harden or Westbrook, would be a little bit more glaring, not a lot more glaring, but enough of a difference between guys like Clay and Steph, especially when you factor in the secondary defenders that Golden State has. I mean, the endless supply of Iguodalas and Livingstons and so forth. I think that they would be able to slow down Oklahoma City just enough, and Oklahoma City's personnel wouldn't be able to do the same in reverse.
I don't buy it. I don't like it. I think you're not giving enough credit to how good those three were, even when they were together in 2011. And then four or five years, I guess, wait, that was 6 or 7 years ago. But they've gotten so much better since then, and they would blow people off the court. Anyways, that strange hypothetical is where we will end things. I hope everyone has a good weekend. Ben, do you have any final thoughts?
No, just please 5-star reviews on iTunes. Andrew, it was great talking to you. Have a great weekend.
Also, shout out to Keystone Matt, who reached out to point out that we were mispronouncing DeJounte Murray's name on last week's podcast. And it's funny, as I was saying his name, I was like, this is probably wrong. But that won't happen again, Seattle. And yeah, we'll be back next Tuesday with a new pod. So thanks.
Yeah. We were not pronouncing his name wrong. I just call him Murray, which is my trick anytime I get into a situation where I don't want to say a name. Like I always call Goran Dragic. I always just call him Goran. So that was my shortcut. If I'm ever going the one name treatment, it's because I don't want to screw up on air.
Yeah.
Anyway, we have a tone to the Seattle basketball community. Everyone who loves our bucket getting talk, please 5 stars on iTunes. We really appreciate it. We'll be back next week, hopefully with more drama concerning all of the most important players like Rajon Rondo and Carmelo Anthony. Until then, have a great weekend, Andrew.
All right, man. Take it easy.
This has been a digital media production. Find your voice.
Another great edition of Open Floor is in the books. Did you know Locked On has a daily podcast for all 30 NBA teams? If you're a Lakers fan, search Locked On Lakers. A Celtics fan, search Locked On Celtics. Warriors fans, search Locked On Warriors. Yes, all 30 NBA teams have a daily bite-sized podcast on the Locked On Podcast Network. Search on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts for Locked On, your favorite team. Or tell your smart speaker to play podcast Locked On, your favorite team.
It's the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.